This is the 107th lecture on the Apocalypse. It's entitled The Seven Shofar Blasts, and this is part one, the first four shofars. They're not trumpets, they're shofars. They're ram's horns. And I will show you why in a minute. But I want you to turn to Revelation chapter 8, verse 7. Again, we've made good progress. Well, I think we've made good progress.
Yes, lots of information in just a few verses.
Revelation 8, verse 7. It says, "The first angel sounded his shofar, and there was hail and fire mixed together in a shower of blood, and they were cast upon the earth. And the third part of the earth was burnt up, and the third part of the trees were burnt up, and all the green grass was burnt up. And the second angel sounded his shofar, and a mass as great as a mountain, burning with fire, was cast into the sea. And a third part of the sea became blood, and a third part of the creatures that were in the sea, which had life, died. And the third part of the ships were destroyed. And the third angel sounded his shofar, and there fell out of the heaven a great meteor, blazing like a torch. And it fell upon a third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the meteor is called the wormwood, or the absinthe. And the third part of the waters became wormwood, or absinthe. And many of the men died of the waters because they had become bitter. And the fourth angel sounded his shofar, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and a third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, so that the third part of them should be darkened, and that the day should not appear for the third part of it, and the night the same. And I saw and I heard a vulture," as it should read. If you've got angel, cross that out. It's wrong. The word is vulture or eagle. Vulture is preferred. "I saw a vulture flying in mid-heaven, saying with a loud voice, 'Woe, woe, woe to them that dwell upon the earth, due to the remaining voices of the shofar of the three angels who are about to sound their shofars.'" Okay, the heavenly hush. Now, if you cast your mind back a few months to when we began in chapter 8, it talks about a hush in heaven that lasts for about half an hour. And the seventh seal has been unlocked by Yeshua in deafening silence. The six previous seals have by this time been opened, they've been unlocked, and the consequences have been of tremendous significance. But this particular seal, the seventh seal on this scroll, is now unlocked and will usher in the consummation of the ages of humankind. Ages of defiance against God and his commandments. Hence the hushed silence as God Almighty takes the awesome step to personally enter into the final stage of man's history. That's why the hush. It's awesome. The creator of the universe, who opens his mouth and out comes mighty suns and planets and galaxies and... I don't know about you, but I cannot contain the thought of creation. Mm-hmm. I cannot contain it. But here is the living God ready himself to enter into man's domain. And once before he entered man's domain, and what happened? We crucified him. Mm-hmm. We crucified God. This time he comes with wrath and anger and vengeance. He comes in response to prayers of saints who are being persecuted, who are crying out, "How long, Lord?" And he responds, "I'm on my way. I'm on my way." If humankind will not submit to his grace and his mercy, they will submit to his artillery. But, little three-letter word. I love those little three-letter words. But. One Christian writer says this about the unexpected delay. He's very eloquent. He's so eloquent I thought I'd include him in this. He says, "When the seventh seal is broken, all we can do is to join the mute messengers, these angels, and silent elders and seek to understand this voiceless utterance, this hushed heralding, this stillness, more awful and full of premonition than if a thousand trumpets had flared forth in clamorous alarm. I found that very profound. I have to stop and think about it. The rage of man, he says, is reckless, thoughtless, unrestrained. All he cares for is to destroy the object of his hate. He will strike as soon as possible. What cares he for his enemy's regard? But God's indignation is of an entirely different stamp. When his judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants will learn righteousness. He makes deliberate haste, I love that, deliberate haste, and holds back his upraised hand. To us, this silent session in the very midst of judgment is the touch which transforms all these terrors from unreasoning, insatiate wrath to careful, calculated indignation, designed to deal out righteousness, not merely unrestrained revenge. This hush in heaven is the stillness before the storm. If the trumpets peal forth his indignation, the silence speaks of his kindness. I had to stop at that point, get my act together, because I started getting emotional, because I thought of all the things that had happened to me in the past, and I was only thinking obsessively. But all the things, all the injustices, all the wrongs that have been committed to me. And then I thought of Glennis and all the things that have happened to her, all the horrible things that have happened over her 30 years. And I thought how I would lash out if I could. All right? And yet the silence speaks of his kindness. In wrath he remembers mercy. Habakkuk 3, verse 2. The pause is brief, but it is eloquent. It bids us remember that the terrific tragedies which follow are not so much as tinged with malice, that they are not only right, but rectifying, and in their final result, but another manifestation of his goodness. And so I had a different view than I had previously of what I was going to discuss and how I was going to discuss it. But you know, the seven archangelic powers that rule the Pleiadian cluster and who stand before the awesome presence of infinite love and infinite intelligence take their shofars and prepare to blast into existence a cosmic corridor for the Lord God to enter human habitation. That's what they're going to do. But it says in that section of Revelation that we read, they prepare to sound. They don't just take the shofars and blast away. They prepare to sound. It's interesting, too, that they are not trumpets. This is based on Zechariah chapter 9. If you look at Zechariah chapter 9 and verse 14 and verse 16, it says, God will be seen over them. His arrow will go forth like lightning, and the Lord God will sound the shofar. And will move in the storm winds of the south. Verse 16, and the Lord their God will save Judah and Israel on that day as the flock of his people. And that's why I wanted today to repeat that song we learned last week, Ephraim and Judah. Most important, to set the stage for this lecture. That the first four shofars blast and shatter the silence of the heavens and shake the earth is the truth of the biblical revelation. It is coming. I've already gone through the sixth seal, which talks about the destruction of Islam. And there's no doubt about that. Muhammad is going to be a dirty name in the future after the sixth seal is released. But there is a question that lingers in the deeper recesses of my mind, all right? To the extent of the coming devastation that is unleashed in the unlocking of the seventh seal by the Mashiach. So deep is this disturbance in my mind, that's what I want to share with you. Now, I've already gone through this in the past. Some of you who were here will remember, lectured way back in lecture 16, was it lecture 20, or was it lecture 28? I did cover some of this, but now I want some of that same information put in a new context, that of the very end of days. Because when you get to Revelation 18, we are confronted with the coming of the Messiah, but what do we find? Analyze it, look at it, take it apart, put it back together again. Do this in your homework in this coming week. Look at Revelation 18, study it carefully, because we do not find a world at war at the coming of Messiah. We find a world at peace. We find a world enjoying harmony among nations. We find material abundance, material prosperity evident everywhere. But this is in direct contrast to what we've been taught, to what churchianity has promulgated to us. It's the exact opposite. It's the exact opposite. We find the world reacting in a hostile way to the coming of Yeshua. And the biblical text says, clearly for a child and a child to understand, it says in Revelation 11, 18, the nations were angry. That's it, Yeshua's intervention. The nations were angry, and your wrath has come, and the time of the dead that they should be judged. And we read that and we say, oh, the nations were angry with each other. Yeah. No, when you read the context, it's the coming of Messiah, and they're angry at him intervening in world affairs. Why? Because they've got the best world imaginable. They've finally got the 666 system. They've got the golden age of man. They've finally reached their pinnacle of Godhead. Their idolatry has come to a massive pimple point. And God's ready to squeeze it. And you know what happens when you've got one of those pimples with maybe one or two different heads, and you squeeze it, bang, off it goes, you've got a duck for cover. The whole world, is that descriptive? The whole world is going to be that pimple point, and God's going to squeeze it. In fact, he's going to squeeze the hell out of it, all right? Fact. It hardly seems possible that there's going to be a world at peace at the coming of Yeshua. It hardly seems possible. But we have been spoon-fed this for centuries. Mm. When you read it, Revelation 18, you find wealthy merchants wailing and bemoaning the fact that in one day, in one hour, the end-time Babylonian system will have been destroyed by God as a consequence of a direct artillery hit with an asteroid. This asteroid is described elsewhere as a millstone. Scientists will know in advance that this is coming from a super technological civilization. You see, when you look out there with your telescopes and all of that, what do you see? You see asteroids, but you can see them. They're all sort of like, you know, horrible things, you know, and great hunks of these things. I think Eros is sort of like that somehow. But this will be a millstone, smooth, like a huge donut. Yeah. They'll look at that and say, well, hang on a minute, something's wrong here. Something is not right. They'll realize months in advance that that thing is heading toward the Mediterranean, and there's nothing they can do to stop it. And each day, we'll be able to go out and see this tiny spot getting bigger and bigger. And as weeks turn into months, you're going to see that larger and larger. It'll finally be the size of a 50-cent piece, and then after a few more months, it's going to be the size of a football. A whole world will see this millstone. Have a look at Revelation 18. Verse 7. How much she has glorified herself at Babylon and lived deliciously. So equate that same amount in ratio in torment and sorrow to her. For she says in her heart, I sit enthroned as a queen and am no widow, and shall see no sorrow. Therefore shall her plagues come in one day: death, mourning, sorrow, famine. She shall be utterly consumed by fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. And the kings of the earth, who have committed immorality and lived in delicious luxury with her, shall bewail her and lament for her when they shall see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for the fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city." Whether we believe this is Babylon on the Euphrates River or whether we believe it's New York City is irrelevant. Whoever it is has a worldwide empire, and God is going to destroy it. It says, "Alas, alas, that mighty city, the great city Babylon, for in 1 hour is your judgment come." Now notice this: "And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buys their merchandise in the markets anymore." So obviously, there's normal market activity all around the world. "The merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones, pearls." Who said that the gold standard's going to be tossed away? Who said gold's not going to be worth anything anymore? Who said silver's finished? Hello? Is there going to be a cashless society? Yes! Will gold be the standard? Yes! Here it is. But all we will have is a number. It's all we'll have is a number. People who are millionaires are going to throw themselves down the, what do you call them? The
elevator
shafts. Like they did in Germany in the Marshall Plan period, and also in the First World War, when men were trying to buy a bottle of milk, and you can see they've got photographs of these people, these Germans with wheelbarrows full of Deutschmarks. You know, trillions of Deutschmarks for bread, for milk. It's coming again. But gold and silver is going to be worth something. And precious stones. Yeah. Diamonds. Pearls. Fine linen. Purple cloth. Silk. Scarlet cloth. Every type of citron wood. All manner of vessels of ivory. All manner of vessels of most expensive wood. Brass. Iron. Marble. Cinnamon. Odors. Ointments. Frankincense. Wine. Olive oil. The finest grade of flour. And wheat. And grain. Cattle, sheep, horses, four-wheeled vehicles, and slaves, and souls of men. Yeah. See how obliquely it reads there, slaves and souls of men. Just in passing, they're the Jews. They're the Jews. It's the time of Jacob's travail. All right? It's the time of Jacob's trouble. Not the world's trouble. The world's trouble is when Yeshua intervenes. But here's a world at peace. But the Jews aren't at peace. They're mentioned just in passing as slaves and souls of men. "And the fruits that your soul lusted after are departed from you, and all things that were luxurious and which shine brightly are departed from you, and you shall find them no more at all. The merchants of these things, which were made wealthy by her, shall stand at a distance for the fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, 'Alas, alas, that great city, that great city, that city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls.'" Sounds pretty good to me. That sounds pretty good to me. "For in 1 hour, so great riches are ruined. And every shipmaster and all the company in ships and mariners and as many as trade by sea stood at a distance and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What city is like this city? This great city?' And they threw dust on their heads and cried and weeping and wailing, saying, 'Alas, alas, the city, that great city, wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea by reason of her abundance of costly items. For in 1 hour is she ruined. Rejoice over her, you heavens, and you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her.' And one angel, one mighty one, took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, 'Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all.' And the voice of musicians like André Rieu, harpers, musicians, those who play flutes and trumpeters shall be no more heard in you at all. No craftsman of whatsoever craft he be shall be found any more in you. And the sound of a millstone shall be heard no more in you at all. And the light of the lamp shall shine no more in you at all. and the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more in you at all. Isn't it amazing? Our view of life, and particularly sexual things, in this Western world, we have gone so far away the Middle Eastern view of life. When the psalmist says, the voice of the bridegroom is heard in the land, you know, hello, think about what that means. Today we've got to keep quiet. The kids will hear. Next door will hear. The people over the street over there will hear. The voice of the bridegroom is heard in the land. And here he says the voice of the bridegroom and the bride shall no more be heard in her. But see, our attitudes have changed in this Western world. We're so warped. We've become perverted. You can't say this. You can't say that. And whatever you do, if you're having an orgasm, keep it quiet. Come on, get real. God doesn't view things like this. He's open.
Neither do humans.
Oh, for shame. So. For your merchants were the great men of the earth. For by your pharmaceutical drugs, please notice this, the Greek word is pharmaceuticals, sorceries. By your drugs were all nations deceived. That's interesting. You know, what do you do when you've got a particular problem? When you go to your doctor, what does the doctor prescribe? Whatever the drug company representative decides you should have. What effects does it have? Well, we don't know. Look, Glennis and I have got friends who are doctors, and we know a bloke, we've known him for many, many years because of my medical background, and he's a psychiatrist. I asked him, point blank, when was this? Going back months now, I said, how do you know what Prozac does, really does? How do you know what this drug and that drug does? He said, oh, we don't really. We don't. He said, if it has a good effect, we use it. No, they don't care. They don't care. By your drugs were all nations deceived, and in her was found the blood of prophets and saints and all that was slain upon the earth. So what you've just read is an economy running beautifully, running smoothly, depending largely on maritime services, uniting the world with cosmetic luxuries in the form of cargo from far across the seas. You know, you don't see a world at war here. You don't see it. Question. Do the effects of the seventh seal, and in particular the seven shofar blasts, or in this situation we're dealing with the first four, do they extend worldwide, or are they local? I've got reasons why I ask this. Where you see the earth mentioned in the apocalypse, does it mean the whole planet earth or does it mean the land of Israel? I've got reasons why I ask this. In Hebrew, earth and land are erets. It could mean the land or it could mean the planet. In Greek, it's gai. All right. Earth or land? This is where interpretation has to come in, because it doesn't say. But we are always reading earth, meaning the planet, in the apocalypse. But I've got serious hesitations about that. I've got reservations, and I want to share these with you, because what I want to see is our knowledge, our understanding, expand of the Word of God. And remember this. The seven shofar blasts occur before Yeshua returns. All right? Keep that in mind because we've just read about the world that will exist at the end of the age and it's at peace. Matthew 24, I want you to have a look at this. Matthew 24, verse 23 and verse 26. And again, my questions today are not posed to upset anybody's personal belief system. All I'm doing is asking questions But I think the questions are valid. They're legitimate. And I want to stimulate your appetite to experience and appreciate the mysteries of God. All right? Somebody read to me Matthew 24, verse 23. Anybody?
At that time, if someone says to you, look, here's the Messiah, or there he is, don't believe him.
Okay, verse 26.
So if people say to you, listen, he's out in the desert, don't go.
Yeah.
Or look, he's hidden away in a secret room, don't believe it.
Yeah. Who's he talking to?
The disciples.
They would know. I mean, he would have talked many, many times about his return. Why on earth would Messiah suggest to them that they should not be taken into a deception involving his return when reports will circulate that the Lord has already returned and is in a wing of the temple, one of the secret chambers of the temple? Why would he have to caution them? Why would he have to say, don't be taken in by that? Or, he's in the Judean desert. That's a reference to all the prophets that talk about Messiah coming back and restoring all the waste places, all the desert places. So, why would he have to caution them if they already knew that his return was going to be so awesome, the whole world would know of it? That's the question. But it doesn't stop there. Isaiah 66 in verse 19. Have a look at what that says, and somebody can read that out too. So you know I'm not pulling your leg. I wouldn't do that. Have a look at Isaiah, not about the Word of God. Might do it about other things, but not necessarily the Word of God. Well, not at all. Have a look at Isaiah 66, 19. Somebody read it out.
I will set aside among them, and I will send some of those who survived to the nations, to Tarshish, to the Libyans, and Lydians, Hamath and Zarchus, to Tubal and Greece, and to the distant islands that have not heard of my fame or seen my glory.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is rather intriguing. Question. Why does Isaiah prophesy that hundreds of thousands of survivors from the old world European civilization will finally receive official word from delegates of the Messianic Kingdom of God, all right, ruling in Jerusalem, Israel, that the Messiah has returned? Why on earth doesn't John say every eye shall see him? Then why are delegates finally going out, perhaps years later, after Messiah's return, to tell him what's happened? The passage tells us that there are Gentiles who missed the event, because they have not seen my glory, it says. So they missed Messiah's glorious return. Look at Revelation 1 verse 7. See the point? Look at Revelation 1 verse 7.
It's all about bringing them to the holy mountain, Jerusalem.
Yeah, and they're saying they have not seen my glory. Well, who was that coming in? Hello? Who was that? Didn't they see it? He comes with clouds, and all the tribes of the earth shall wail and mourn because of him. But we've seen that Isaiah begs to differ. If this is a worldwide event.
Israel.
Yeah, the tribes of Israel. It's based on Zechariah. It's based on Zechariah 12 verse 10. It says very clearly, and this, of course, is not Zechariah's prophecy. This is Jeremiah's prophecy attached by the rabbis in Zechariah, because Jeremiah had a whole lot of stuff that he wrote, and they didn't know what to do with it. So they put it on, they added it to Zechariah's prophecies. And this is why the anti-missionaries turn around and say, Yeshua was a liar. He was a biblically ignorant individual, because he referred to a prophecy in Zechariah, but he said, Jeremiah said. Well, let me tell you something. Jeremiah did say it. And it's in Zechariah's prophecies attached to Zechariah's scroll. And the rabbis understand this. All right. It says in Zechariah 12:10, they shall look unto me whom they have thrust through, and they shall mourn and wail for him as one mourns for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him. And look at chapter, same chapter, 12 and verse 11. in the same context. In that day there shall be a great mourning and wailing in Jerusalem, as the mourning of Hadad Rimon in the valley of Megiddon. What kind of mourning was that? Well, that was when Psalm 89 brings out, God appears to have committed a lie. Because Jeremiah, who's writing Psalm 89, he says, Lord, here's the Davidic covenant. This is what you promised. You would always be faithful to King David and to his descendants. There would always be a man to sit on David's throne, and you love Israel, and so on and so forth. And then at the end of the psalm, he says, what have you done? This is a tragedy. The nations hate us. We're slaves. The Davidic covenant's been broken. The crown has been lost, trampled underfoot. Well, it was King Josiah. His crown was trampled underfoot. And then after him came the destruction, the terrible destruction. Some years later, I think 22 years later, was the destruction of Judah. But he's talking specifically here of the great mourning that occurred when a young man, a young king, Josiah, was killed. Look at verse 11. And the land shall mourn, every family apart, the family of the house of David apart, their wives apart, the family of the house of Nathan apart, and their wives apart, the family of the house of Levi apart, and their wives apart, the family of Shammai apart, and their wives apart, all the families that remain, every family apart, and their wives apart. A great mourning. But the very fact that he writes it like this shows that at the end of the age, the greater Israel has already occurred, and the kingdoms have been restored to Israel and Judah. Their fortunes have been restored at the very end of the age. Israel's having a golden age at the end of the age, and the Mosaic economy is in full swing at the end of the age, because all the families of David are represented there in the cities of Israel. But they don't mourn together. The women are separate to the men, and so on and so forth. So here is the Mosaic economy in full swing, which expositors of the Bible overlook. But Elijah is coming back. Who he will be, no one knows. But he will come back and restore the entire Mosaic economy. But it's talking about the land of Israel. These prophecies in Zechariah, spoken by Jeremiah, pertain to the land. It's not talking about the world. And when John quotes and says, every eye will see him, they also that pierced him, he's talking about the land of Israel.
Well, nobody else will really care, will they?
That
nobody else will be worried or concerned that the Messiah has come. We won't be here. The first fruit will be already met him in the air and come down with him.
We'll be up and down, yeah. That's right. That's right.
And so all the unbelievers, they couldn't care less.
Mm. But they would.
And his people,
but the
Israel,
yes,
will know. Well, because they are the ones that have shown
him. Well, this is true. That's true.
And the other,
but the Gentiles at least would know that he's returned, surely. But this is not what seems to be the case. And of course, when you're looking at the apocalypse, you've got to remember this is a Jew writing, thinking in Aramaic or Hebrew, but writing in Greek. Or a Jew thinking in Aramaic or Hebrew and writing in Aramaic and Hebrew, which was then later translated from Aramaic and Hebrew into Greek. Either way, this explains the disjointedness of the apocalypse. There's a lot in the apocalypse that is terribly ungrammatical in Greek, and all the academics acknowledge this. But the thing is, you've got to remember, he was thinking one way and writing another, if in fact he wrote it in Greek. So every eye shall see him refers to the land. And remember, they also who pierced him lived locally. They didn't live in Europe, Australia, Tanzania, Nigeria, Tasmania, or anywhere else. All the tribes of the earth will mourn over him refers to the restored tribes of Israel at the end of days in the land. And so it is all the tribes of the land will mourn for him. But I've taught until fairly recently that every eye on earth will see him as he returns. Because, you see, the planet is revolving on its axis. So as the Lord is descending and all the saints with him and all the angels of heaven with him, as the earth revolves, every land would be exposed to the Messiah before he touches his feet on the Mount of Olives. But Yeshua said, as lightning flashes from the east to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. But I had that lightning taking a full 24 hours to flash from the east to the west. Now, I've always had difficulty with that. So I said, oh, the lightning must be the lighting. That is, the sunrise and the shining of the sun going right across to the west. The Greek does not support that. So I've had to come to a point recently, in recent years, where I've said, well, look, it's obviously talking about the land. Therefore, I'm going to have to readjust my thinking cap here and my perspective on the apocalypse and on all the prophecies relating to the coming of Mashiach. But this helps us understand the message of the apocalypse. It's for the state of Israel. It's not for anyone else. It's about the state of Israel at the end of the age, and it's about the leading contenders and pretenders to that land. Does it belong to the Jews or does it belong to Esau? Esau, a pain in the backside, honestly.
Yes.
He's always cropping up at the wrong time in the wrong place, but he wants that land back. He wants it back. And who is Esau today? Just about everybody on earth. The Edomites have mixed up with everybody on earth.
The haters.
All right. Luke 21:21. You know, these events at the end of the age are going to impact on the Middle East and not the entire world as such. This is why he says to his followers, do not enter the borders of the state of Israel at the end of the age.
Who does it say that?
Luke 21:21. Mm-hmm. When Jerusalem is surrounded by armies, okay, look at verse 21. Let them who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let them who are in the midst of it, that's the state of Israel, depart out. And let them not that are in the countries enter therein too.
Okay.
Now, it's not saying that we shouldn't visit Israel, but Yeshua is saying, watch the timing. Watch out for the timing. Watch out for the timing. He says, you know, if you're in Israel, he says, get out. If you're in Judea and you can get out, get to the mountains. And if you're in the rest of the world, in the countries, don't go in. Stay out.
It's Jerusalem you have to get out of.
Jerusalem specifically. Yeah. But it says when you are in, if you're in Jerusalem, the previous verse, two verses, Jerusalem will be surrounded by armies. And then he says, when you see that, get out. Well, if you're surrounded by armies, you're going to have a tough time getting out of Jerusalem. So, if the Antichrist's rule is worldwide, now hear me here, I do believe there will be a world government. There's no doubt about that. Therefore, all nations on earth will form some form of a federal state, a world federal state. No doubt in my mind. But if he tells those who are in the state of Israel to get out, isn't it going to be more precarious for the state of Israel and the people in it than out? Otherwise, why would he have said, get out? Let the penny drop from it.
Mm.
It would be as precarious for Jews outside the land if it was a world ruling government controlled by the Antichrist as it would be for Jews in the land. I'm a Jew. I want to know what to do. Tell me, you know, because this is a frightening thought. We know there will be global satellite systems that will penetrate into your own homes at the end of the age. We know that. It's already here. They've got the optic eye on the TV. We've got the microphone in the Ostar box. We've got all that all ready to go. And we know that at the end of the age, Zechariah says there will be something up there in the sky and it's going to be able to look straight down in your home and destroy it if there's any theft occurring. In other words, if you're trying to work the angles on your computer with your number, you don't think you're getting enough each week, and you try to hack into that computer system of the beast, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be in trouble. But Yeshua said, if you're in the midst of Israel at that time, depart out. And that would include advice to Jews and Gentiles, both. So it's high time, methinks, to rethink on some of these issues.
It's obviously not going to happen on a mass scale, otherwise it would look too suspicious.
Wouldn't it?
Well, it would.
It'd be a bit like Europe, the coming Hitler power. Those who got out when they could see that there was going to be a problem were the ones that survived.
When they got out very early in the piece. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. 3 points.
So how do we know where just before that it says that nation shall fight against nation mm-hmm. and kingdom against kingdom and so on. Sure. That is referring to the whole earth, isn't it?
That's referring, well, it seems to be.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say that.
It's already started to happen.
Things are happening on a world scale now.
So we have to just in our mind see how much of it is worldwide and how much
and how much is pertinent to just the Middle East. That's right. But herein lies the difficulty. As I said, this is the problem. And it's a problem perceptually as well. We've got it because we've got to actually dismantle previous ideologies, previous constructs to ally ourselves with what is the truth of the matter. But it becomes a real challenge for all of us to sit down and analyse it and take it apart and put it back together again. It makes it very hard.
Because where it says there were earthquakes and tsunamis and things, that couldn't all just be...
In the Middle East.
In the Middle East. No. That's got to be worldwide.
Yeah. So if you look at this point, my question is, will the Antichrist expect everyone on the planet to conform to the acquisition of the mark? That's perhaps the most important question we can ask, seeing what's coming. Because we've assumed everyone on planet Earth will have to take the mark that issues forth from a government body, a central office, if you will, of the Antichrist system. Because in Revelation 13, verse 7 and 16, Revelation 13, verse 7 and 16, we are told that HaSatan will extend his authority through the Antichrist to the whole world, or Earth. Earth. So here again, we're assuming that it's the Earth. It may not. It may be the land. Same word, whether we have Hebrew or Greek. Same word. So that's an assumption. We need to rethink it. Point two as a question. Will everyone on earth worship this dictator who possesses enormous personality disorders? As I said last in the last lecture about on the apocalypse, I said that he had BPD, all right, and he also had special person misconception. So that's an SPN. So he's a BPD and SPN. So borderline personality disorder on the one hand and special person misconception on the other. All right. So we've assumed everyone on the planet, with the exception of messianic believers, will worship him. We've assumed that. Because it says in Revelation 13:8, all the world will worship, all the earth, should get it right, all the earth, see I'm having trouble already, all the earth will worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life. So see, take it easy, relax. If your name is written in the book of life, you're not going to worship it, and you're not going to receive the mark anyway. Having said that, we have wrongly taken, I believe, what John wrote to refer to the globe, not merely the land of Israel. Which leads me to the third question, major question, as a point. Will everyone on earth be disadvantaged economically if they refuse the mark of the beast? And this perhaps is the most important of my questions. It's the most important because we have all assumed, because of our misunderstanding of earth and land, that all who reject the mark of the beast, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name, will suffer enormous economic disadvantage. Revelation 13, 17 seems to indicate that. It seems to indicate that. But if John is speaking of events in the Holy Land only, then we begin to realize that we have misunderstood one of the most prime principles of biblical exegesis, and that is we have overlooked the infamous synecdoche. I know you all understand what that is, don't you?
Yes.
The synecdoche.
I agree.
Yes. You're safe in taking that approach. You all know what a synecdoche is. I'm going to put this on the board here so you can look it up yourself later.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm serious. Synecdoche. Synecdoche. There it is. Synecdoche. And, of course, it's a figure of speech, particularly in Jewish thought form, where the whole is used to stand for a part, where one word substitutes for another in such a way as to imply a unity in difference. All. We could say, all the world loves Coca-Cola. But does that mean every single individual in the world loves Coca-Cola? All right. No. I saw a tragic thing the other day. I was in Tweed City, and there was this fellow, overweight, bigger than I am, huge, sitting there, and he had a bottle of Coca-Cola, and he was savouring it like a good glass of wine. I wanted to cry. He was there going,
Maybe he's been paid to test it.
He might have been, but it was almost comical. And I thought, oh, you poor fella, you know, you need a good red, mate, you know, or whatever. Not a bottle of Coca-Cola. A synecdoche is understood as simply as everyone in the ecclesia loved the rabbi. Everyone really loved him. Well, Owen may not. George may not. You thought I was going to point to you. All right.
You might just like it.
It's an exaggeration. All right. And, we entered the conflict with 6,000 guns, meaning, of course, there were 6,000 infantry, not literally 6,000 guns. The whole world is under the sway of Americanisms. Well, no, it's not. All hands on deck. Okay, there's a synecdoche. You know, all these hands all over the... We want our children to join us in getting the clothes off the line because it's going to rain. Well, no, we don't want them literally to join us. You know, we'd be walking around, so very odd. So, and so on it goes. So, you know, if you look at Daniel chapter 2, verse 37, you'll find a good example of a synecdoche. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory, and wheresoever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven exist. He has given all these into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. No, he hadn't. No, he hadn't. But that's a synecdoche, all right? It's a monumental exaggeration. And of course, if you look at closer to home, Colossians chapter 1. Colossians chapter 1, verse 5 and 6. Paul says that the gospel at that time had gone to the entire world. And especially verse 23. He said it's been preached to every creature under heaven. Well, I think that's a good example of a synecdoche. Because did Paul take the gospel to Germany, Scandinavia, Parthia, Scotland, Iceland, Brazil? Did the gospel go to the Amerindian tribes that were invading the continental United States at that time, or Japan, or Siberia? Did the gospel go to all of those places in the first century? But Paul said, the whole world's heard it. Well, that's a synecdoche. I can't even say it. That's a synecdoche. Figures of speech were in common use in the first century. This is why, when it comes to a universal salvation, I do not place any confidence in the word all. A lot of universalists do. But I use theology to prove the point of a universal salvation. I use an appreciation of the grace of God, the limitless, salvific love and grace of God to prove a universal salvation. And then, with that as my foundation, I can then read what Paul writes or others write about all people being saved. But it's based not on the word all, but most other sites who are into a universal salvation lay great claim on that little three-letter word. I won't do that. I go to the nature of God each and every time. And you know what? In doing that, I cannot be proved wrong. Can't. Because the nature of God never changes. And that recent fundamentals lecture I gave on universal salvation, I don't use all as the basis at all. If you go back to that and have a look at that fundamentals on the site, you'll find it is the salvific nature of God upon which I prove that thesis. All right. Even Karl Barth, who wrote awesome works, finally said in the last analysis, I believe God will save all because he is love, and therefore I hope. I hope. Had he understood the plan of God in Jewish thought form through the revelation of the festivals and what they mean, he would have had a more positive hope. No doubt about that. But the character of grace, the character of God, is the basis for my belief in a universal salvation, as it was Athanasius, as it was Jerome, as it was Clement of Alexandria, as it was the early church fathers. They all based universal salvation on the character of grace. But will the final kingdom of the Antichrist be all-inclusive as far as cooperation and economic political alliances are concerned? If it is, we've got a problem, because in Daniel 11:44, please turn there, I'll finish this in a second, Daniel 11:44, at the height of his power, when he occupies the temple in Jerusalem, it says, rumours out of the east, that's east of Jerusalem, and out of the north, that's north of Jerusalem, will trouble him. Please notice it. So if the federation of this world state is as tight as it's been imagined in times past, then something is not quite right. Something is rotten in Denmark, as they say, or at that time in Jerusalem, as it should be. Clearly, there will be key nations who will sidestep and resist his military advances. I know this. Because if you look at Daniel 11:41, you find the people of Edom, Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon in what is today Transjordan resisting the Antichrist. They slip right out from the radar. They escape out of his hand. So have they taken the mark of the beast? No. Obviously not. If those nations have avoided taking the mark of the beast, how many others will avoid taking the mark of the beast? We get a good indication that there are going to be difficulties, because have a look at Revelation 16. Revelation 16 and verse 13. Revelation 16 and verse 13. Because here you will find three demonic frogs, okay? Frog-like demonic powers, who begin working miracles through political ambassadors in order to seduce the rulers of the earth to join in with the Antichrist to make war against the coming Messiah. If they had to resort to those kind of machinations to seduce the rulers of the world to fight the Messiah at his return, clearly they weren't already involved in a one world state. After all, they had to go out and seduce them into fighting the Messiah at his return. So this activity would be entirely unnecessary to accomplish if the entire world was already successfully governed as a collective multicultural unity. It wouldn't be necessary to do it. Plus, how long does he reign? The Antichrist.
7 years.
Some say seven, some say 3.5 years, some say longer, some say 45 days. So, that would not be time enough for him to implement a worldwide, global Mark of the Beast implementation. Wouldn't be enough time. You got billions of people on this planet. It wouldn't be enough time, despite the great computer they have in the ACT linked to something called the Beast over there in Brussels, major, huge undertaking that people have created to make sure everybody is listed on it. All right, Revelation 14. Revelation 14. See, what I'm trying to do today is to get you to think about what you study. Think. Revelation 14 and verse 9 through to verse 11. Glennis, do you want to read that?
Then another angel, a third, followed them, who said with a loud voice, "Whoever worships the beast and his statue and receives the mark on his forehead or in his hand shall drink of the wine of God's wrath that has been mixed undiluted in the cup of his anger. And he shall be tortured with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb. The smoke of their torture ascends forever and ever, and the worshippers of the beast and of his statue, as well as anyone with the mark of his name, will enjoy no rest day or night."
All right. Now, there it is. I'm going to have fun when I get to that and explain what that means. But in the meantime, those who take the mark of the beast are going to be tormented in hell. And in fact, in other places in Revelation, we find that the beast will kill anybody who does not take the mark. Question. Who is left for Yeshua to rule over when he returns? If you've got people who get killed because they won't take the mark of the beast, and those who do are going to be tormented in hell, which presumably is the whole world, who's left for Yeshua to reign over for 1,000 years? Obviously nobody, and the SDAs are right. We're all going to heaven to read pornography for 1,000 years. See, this is the problem. Think. We know that we know that there will be entire nations that the Lord Yeshua will rule over for this period of time. We know that because the Bible's full of this information. Egypt will experience the reign of Yeshua over them. We are told that in Zechariah chapter 14. And if they don't come up to the Feast of Tabernacles, to Sukkot, he's going to send a plague on them. Didn't they take the beast's name, number, or mark? If they did, they'd be in hell, burning. If they didn't, they would have been killed. That leaves me with only one recourse to solve the problem. They didn't take the mark, the number, or anything else of the beasts. And yet they are mentioned primarily in Daniel as falling before the Antichrist, as being conquered by the Antichrist. Read it. Daniel 11, verses 40 to 45, he says, the land of Egypt will not escape. All right? So quite apparently, the Egyptians will sneak out of the taking of the mark of the beast. You know, join the dots. They will be neither murdered en masse by the Antichrist nor sentenced to hell by Mashiach, because Yeshua is going to reign over them. And if they don't cooperate, they're not going to give them reign in due season. So does this give us any hope where before, according to church teachings, there was no hope? I would say so. There will be entire nations. Now listen to me. Take a mental note on paper. This is so important. There will be entire nations who will be considered blessed by Yeshua in the judgment at his return, precisely because of their treatment toward the people of Israel at the end of the age. So stop and think about what I just said. Matthew chapter 25 talks about the coming of Messiah and all the nations are brought before him, and those who have treated Israel well will be blessed. You mean there are people out there, nations out there, that are going to treat the Jews fairly at the end of the age? Yeah. Baruch Hashem. There will be. Otherwise... Sorry?
All the Christian Zionists.
Yes. So, yes. So, here we have just ripped apart the entire biblical concept that the world's churches have got about the Antichrist. Absolutely. By doing nothing but asking questions and joining the dots. Finally, the usual scenario of the very last days, painted from the pages of the Apocalypse, is entirely of the earth in the death throes of violent warfare, horrendous social, economic, planetary upheavals, and the unleashing of devastating angelic plagues all over the planet. Men will be cursing God, they'll be screaming in agony as hideous large boils erupt all over their bodies. Now, I'm not demoting that picture because it's plainly there, but my question is it really that simple that it's going to be the whole world, or is it just the land? And is this one of the reasons why Yeshua said, look, if you're there at the end, get out? It would make more sense. Because at the same time that Messiah returns, you find the entire world at peace and enjoying the advantages that have come as a consequence of Antichrist's rule. We just went through that in Revelation 18. So I've got questions. And I hope that after today, you too will have questions. Because the more questions you have about it, the more you will be at peace in yourself. You won't be in confusion, you'll be more at peace. Because you'll see the tension that exists between this statement and this statement can be resolved by simply changing a word. It's like forever. Hola. Aeon. Or forever and ever. Or forever and ever and ever. How many evers and forevers and, you know... can we have before we lose sense of the whole point of language? So the first blast of the shofar, fire ushers from the skies, mingled with blood. But you know what? That doesn't make any sense until you read books about phenomena that have occurred all over the world in the past, in the last few thousand years, and even in recent history. People have seen red blooded rains, red blooded snowfalls. It smells like blood, looks like blood, tastes repugnant like blood. It's blood. Where does it come from? I don't know. Out of the sky. But it does happen. It does happen. The Sibylline oracles mention a rain of fire and blood at the end of days. Also speaks of a great star falling from heaven into the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. But the four shofar horns, which no longer exist up here.
Because you wiped them all away.
Because I wiped them all away. And in a way, I hope I have, as far as the whole planet is concerned, will be the subject of the next lecture on the apocalypse. Because they are horrific. And whether they are located in the land of Israel or at the end of the age worldwide as global horrors, we will have to contend with it one way or another, because even if it's only locally in the Middle East, the results economically are not going to be good for the rest of the world, as indicated in Revelation 18 anyway. So rather than continue on with this, I'll continue this next lecture on the apocalypse. But if you have any questions at the moment about any of that in relation to what I've already discussed, take advantage of my being here now and ask.